Welcome to the first part of Discourses upon the Existence and Attributes of God by Stephen Charnock, Volume 2. This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books, many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalogue containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, CDs and much more at great discounts, are on the web at www.swrb.com. Also, please consider, pray and act upon the important truths found in the following quotation by Charles Spurgeon. As the Apostle says to Timothy, so also he says to everyone, give yourselves to reading. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read. Renounce as much as you will all light literature, but study as much as possible sound theological works, especially the Puritanic writers and expositions of the Bible. The best way for you to spend your leisure is to be either reading or praying. And now to SWRB's reading of the History of Redemption, which we hope you find to be a great blessing, and which we pray draws you nearer to the Lord Jesus Christ. For he is the way, the truth, and the life, and no man cometh unto the Father but by him. John 14, verse 6. Discourse 10, on the power of God. Job 26, verse 14. Lo, these are parts of his ways, but how little a portion is heard of him. But the thunder of his power, who can understand? Bildad had, in the foregoing chapter, entertained Job with a discourse of the dominion and power of God, and the purity of his righteousness, whence he argues an impossibility of the justification of man in his presence, who is no better than a worm. Job, in this chapter, acknowledges the greatness of God's power, and descants more largely upon it than Bildad had done, but doth preface it with a kind of ironical speech, as if he had not acted a friendly part, or spake little to the purpose, or the matter in hand. The subject of Job's discourse was the worldly happiness of the wicked, and the calamities of the godly, and Bildad reads him a lecture of the extent of God's dominion, the number of his armies, and the unspotted rectitude of his nature, in comparison of which the purest creatures are foul and crooked. Job, therefore, from verse 1 to 4, taxeth him in a kind of scoffing manner, that he had not touched the point, but rambled from the subject in hand, and had not applied a salve proper to this sore, verse 2. How hast thou helped him that is without power? How savest thou the arm of him that hath no strength, etc.? Your discourse is so impertinent that it will neither strengthen a weak person nor instruct a simple one. But since Bildad would take up the argument of God's power and discourse so short of it, Job would show that he wanted not his instructions in that kind, and that he had more distinct conceptions of it than his antagonist had uttered. And therefore, from verse 5 to the end of the chapter, he doth magnificently treat of the power of God in several branches. And verse 5, he begins with the lowest. Dead things are formed from under the waters, and the inhabitants thereof. You read me a lecture of the power of God in the heavenly host. Indeed, it is visible there, yet of a larger extent, and monuments of it are found in the lower parts. What do you think of those dead things under the earth and waters, of the corn that dies and by the moisturing influences of the clouds springs up again with a numerous progeny and increase for the nourishment of man? What do you think of those varieties of metals and minerals conceived in the bowels of the earth, those pearls and riches in the depths of the waters, midwifed by this power of God. Add to these those more prodigious creatures in the sea, the inhabitants of the waters, with their vastness and variety, which are all the births of God's power, both in their first creation by his mighty voice, and their propagation by his cherishing providence. Stop not here, but consider also that his power extends to hell, either the graves, the repositories of all the crumbled dust that hath yet been in the world, for so hell is sometimes spoken of in Scripture, verse 6, hell is naked before him, and destruction hath no covering. The several lodgings of deceased men are known to him. No screen can obscure them from his sight, nor their dissolution be any bar to his power. When the time is come to compact those moulded bodies, to entertain again their departed souls, either for weal or woe. The grave, or hell, the place of punishment, is naked before him, as distinctly discerned by him, as a naked body in all its lineaments by us, or a deceptive body in all its parts by a skilful eye. Destruction hath no covering. None can free himself from the power of his hand. Every person in the bowels of hell, every person punished there, is known to him, and fears the power of his wrath. From the lower parts of the world, he ascends to the consideration of the power of God in the creation of heaven and earth. He stretches out the north over the empty places, in verse 7. The north, or the north pole, over the air, which by the Greeks was called void or empty, because of the tenuity and thinness of that element. And he mentions here the north, or north pole, for the whole heaven, because it is more known and apparent than the southern pole. And hangs the earth upon nothing. The massy and weighty earth hangs like a thick globe in the midst of a thin air, that there is as much air on the one side of it as on the other. The heavens have no prop to sustain them in their height, and the earth has no basis to support it in its place. The heavens are as if you saw a curtain stretched smooth in the air, without any hand to hold it. And the earth is as if you saw a ball hanging in the air, without any solid body to underprop it, or any line to hinder it from falling, both standing monuments of the omnipotence of God. He then takes notice of his daily power in the clouds. He binds up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not rent under them. Verse 8. He compacts the waters together in clouds, and keeps them by his power in the air against the force of their natural gravity and heaviness, till they are fit to flow down upon the earth and perform his pleasure in the places for which he designs them. The cloud is not rent under them. The thin air is not split asunder by the weight of the waters contained in the cloud above it. He causes them to distill by drops, and strains them, as it were, through a thin lawn for the refreshment of the earth, and suffers them not to fall in the whole lump, with a violent torrent, to waste the industry of man, and bring famine upon the world by destroying the fruits of the earth. What a wonder it would be to see but one entire drop of water hang itself but one inch above the ground, unless it be a bubble which is preserved by the air enclosed within it. What a wonder would it be to see a gallon of water contained in a thin cobweb as strongly as in a vessel of brass. Great is the wonder of divine power in those thin bottles of heaven, as they are called, in Job 38, verse 37, and therefore called his clouds here, as being daily instances of his omnipotence, that the air should sustain those rolling vessels, as it should seem, weightier than itself, that the force of this mass of water should not break so thin a prison and hasten to its proper place, which is below the air, that they should be daily confined against their natural inclination, and held by so slight a chain, and there should be such a gradual and successive falling of them, as if the air were pierced with holes like a gardener's watering pot, and not fall in one entire body to drown or drench some parts of the earth. These are hourly miracles of divine power, as little regarded as clearly visible. He proceeds, verse 9. He holds back the face of his throne and spreads the clouds upon it. The clouds are designed as curtains to cover the heavens, as well as vessels to water the earth, in Psalm 147, verse 8, and Isaiah 66, verse 1. And the earth is footstool. The heavens are called his throne, because his power doth most shine forth there, and magnificently declare the glory of God. And the clouds are as a screen between the scorching heat of the sun, and the tender plants of the earth, and the weak bodies of men. From hence he descends to the sea, and considers the divine power apparent in the bounding of it, verse 10. He has compassed the water with waters with bounds till the day and night come to an end. This is several times mentioned in Scripture as a signal mark of divine strength. In Job 38, verse 8, and Proverbs 38, verse 8, and 8, verse 27. He hath measured a place for the sea, and struck the limits of it as with a compass, that it might not mount above the surface of the land, and ruin the ends of the earth's creation. And this, while day and night have their mutual turns, till he shall make an end of time by the removing of the measures of it. The bounds of the tumultuous sea are, in many places, as weak as the bottles of the upper waters. The one is contained in thin air, and the other restrained by weak sands in many places, as well as by stubborn rocks in others. And though it swells, forms, roars, and the waves, encouraged and egged on by strong winds, come like mountains against the shore, they overflow it not, but humble themselves when they come near to those sands, which are set as their lists and limits, and retire back to the womb, which that brought them forth, as if they were ashamed and repented of their proud invasion. Or else it may be meant of the tides of the sea, and the stated time God has set it for its ebbing and flowing, till night and day come to an end. Both that the fluid waters should contain themselves within due bounds, and keep their perpetually orderly motion, are amazing arguments of divine power. He passes on to the consideration of the commotions in the air and earth, raised and stilled by the power of God. The pillars of heaven tremble, and are astonished at its reproof. By pillars of heaven are meant angels, as some think, but either the air, called the pillars of heaven in regard of place, as it continues and knits together the parts of the world, as pillars do the upper and nether parts of a building, as the lowest parts of the earth are called the foundations of the earth, so the lowest parts of the heaven may be called the pillars of heaven. Or else by that phrase may be meant mountains, which seem at a distance to touch the sky, as pillars do the top of a structure. And so it may be spoken according to vulgar capacity, which imagines the heavens to be sustained by the two extreme parts of the earth, as a convex body, to be arched by pillars. Whence the Scripture, according to common apprehensions, mentions the ends of the earth and the utmost parts of the heavens, though they have properly no end, as being round. The power of God is seen in those commotions in the air and earth, by thunders, lightnings, storms, earthquakes, which wreck the air, and make the mountains and hills tremble as servants before a frowning and rebuking master. And he makes motions in the earth and air, so is his power seen in their influences upon the sea. He judges the sea with his power, and by his understanding he smites through the proud. Verse 12. At the creation, he put the waters into several channels, and caused the dry land to appear barefaced for a habitation for man and beast. Or rather, he splits the sea by storms, as though he would make the bottom the deep visible, and rakes up the sands to the surface of the waters, and marshals the waves into mountains and valleys. After that, he smites through the proud, that is, he humbles the proud waves, and by laying the storm, reduces them to their former level. The power of God is visible, as well in a rebuking as in awakening the winds. He makes them sensible of his voice, and according to his pleasure, exasperates or calms them. The striking through the proud here is not probably meant the destruction of the Egyptian army, for some guess that Job died that year, or about the time of the Israelites coming out of Egypt. So this discourse here, being in the time of his affliction, could not point at that which was done after his restoration to his temporal prosperity. And now, at last, he sums up the power of God in the chiefest of his works above, and the greatest wonder of his works below, verse 13. By his Spirit he hath garnished the heavens. His hand hath formed the crooked serpent. The greater and lesser lights, sun, moon, and stars, the ornaments and furniture of heaven, and the whale, the prodigious monument of God's power, often mentioned in Scripture to this purpose, and in particular in this book of Job, in chapter 41, and called by the same name of crooked serpent in Isaiah 27 verse 1, where it is applied by way of metaphor to the king of Assyria or Egypt, or all oppressors of the church. Various interpretations there are of this crooked serpent. Some understand that constellation in heaven, which astronomers call the dragon, some that combination of weaker stars, which they call a galaxia, which winds about the heavens. But it is most probable that Job, drawing near to the conclusion of his discourse, joins the greatest testimonies of God's power in the world, the highest heavens, and the lowest Leviathan, which is here called a bar serpent, in regard to his strength and hardness, as mighty men are called bars in Scripture, in Jeremiah 51, verse 30. Her bars are broken things. And in regard to this power of God in the creation of this creature, it is particularly mentioned in the catalogue of God's works in Genesis 1, verse 21. And God created great whales, all the other creatures being put into one sum and not particularly expressed. And now he makes use of this lecture in the text. Lo, these are parts of his ways. But how little a portion is heard of him, but the thunder of his power, who can understand? This is but a small landscape of some of his works of power, the outsides and extremities of it. More glorious things are within his palaces, though those things argue a stupendous power of the Creator in his works of creation and providence, yet they are nothing to what may be declared of his power. and what may be declared is nothing to what may be conceived, and what may be conceived is nothing to what is above the conceptions of any creature. These are but little crumbs and fragments of that infinite power, which is, in his nature, like a drop in comparison of the mighty ocean, a hiss or whisper in comparison of a mighty voice of thunder. This which I have spoken is but a spark to the fiery region, a few lines by and by, a drop of speech. The thunder of his power. Some understand it of thunder literally, for material thunder in the air, the thunder of his power, that is, according to the Hebrew dialect, his powerful thunder. This is not a sense. The nature of thunder in the air doth not so much exceed the capacity of human understanding. It is therefore rather to be understood metaphorically, the thunder of his power, that is, the greatness and immensity of his power, manifested in the magnificent miracles of nature, in the consideration whereof men are astonished, as if they had heard an unusual clap of thunder. So thunder is used in Job 39:25, the thunder of the captains, that is, the strength and force of the captains of an army. And verse 19, God speaking of Job, of a horse, saith, hast thou clothed his neck with thunder? That is strength. And thunder being a mark of the power of God, some of the heathen have called God by the name of a thunderer. As thunder pierceth the lowest parts and alters the state of things, so doth the power of God penetrate into all things whatsoever. The thunder of his power, that is, the greatness of his power, as the strength of salvation in Psalm 20 verse 6, that is, a mighty salvation. Who can understand? Who is able to count all the monuments of his power? How doth this little, which I have spoken of, exceed the capacity of our understanding, and is rather the matter of our astonishment than the object of our comprehensive knowledge? The power of the greatest potentate, or the mightiest creature, is but of small extent. None but have their limits. It may be understood how far they can act, in what sphere their activity is bounded. But when I have spoken all of divine power that I can, when you have thought all that you can think of, your souls will prompt you to conceive something more beyond what I have spoken and what you have thought. His divine power shines in everything, is beyond everything. There is infinitely more power lodged in his nature, not expressed to the world. The understanding of men and angels, centered in one creature, would fall short of their perception of the infiniteness of it. All that can be comprehended of it are but little fringes of it, a small portion. No man ever discoursed or can of God's power according to the magnificence of it. No creature can conceive it. God himself only comprehends it. God himself is only able to express it. Man's power being limited, his line is too short to measure the incomprehensible omnipotence of God. The thunder of his power, who can understand? That is, none can. The text is a lofty declaration of the divine power with a particular note of attention low. In the expressions of it, in the works of creation and providence, lo, these are his ways. Ways and works excelling any created strength. Referring to the little summary of them he had been made before. And two, in the insufficiency of these ways to measure his power. But how little a portion is heard of him. Three, in the incomprehensibleness of it, the thunder of his power. Who can understand? Doctrine. Infinite an incomprehensible power pertains to the nature of God and is expressed in part in his works. Although there be a mighty expression of divine power in his works, yet an incomprehensible power pertains to his nature. The thunder of his power, who can understand? His power glitters in all his works, as well as his wisdom. In Psalm 62, verse 11, twice have I heard this, that power belongs to God. In the law and in the prophets, some say, but why power twice, and not mercy, which he speaks of in the following verse? He had heard of power twice, from the voice of creation and from the voice of government. Mercy was heard in government after man's fall, not creation. Innocent man was an object of God's goodness, not of his mercy, till he had made himself miserable. Power was expressed in both, for twice I heard that power belongs to God. That is, it is a certain and undoubted truth that power is essential to the divine nature. It is true, mercy is essential. Justice is essential. But power more apparently essential, because no acts of mercy or justice or wisdom can be exercised by him without power. The repetition of a thing confirms the certainty of it. Some observe that God is called Almighty 70 times in Scripture. Though his power be evident in all his works, yet he hath a power beyond the expression of it in his works, which, as it is the glory of his nature, so it is the comfort of a believer. To which purpose the apostle expresses it by an excellent paraphrase for the honour of the divine nature, Ephesians 3, verse 20. Now unto him that is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think, unto him be glory in the churches. We have reason to acknowledge him, Almighty, who hath a power of acting above our power or understanding. Who could have imagined such a powerful operation in the propagation of the gospel and the conversion of the Gentiles, which the apostle seems to hint at in that place? His power is expressed by horns in his hands, Habakkuk 3, verse 4, because all the works of his hands are wrought with almighty strength. Power is also used as a name of God in Mark 14, verse 62, the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, that is, at the right hand of God. God and power are inseparable, that they are reciprocated. As his essence is immense, not to be confined in place, as it is eternal, not to be measured by time, so it is almighty, not to be limited in regard of action. 1. It is ingeniously illustrated by some by a unit. All the numbers depend upon it. It makes numbers by addition, multiplies them inexpressibly. When one unit is removed from a number, how vastly doth it diminish it? It gives perfection to all other numbers. It receives perfection from none. If you add a unit before 100, how doth it multiply it to 1,100? If you set a unit before 20 million, it presently makes the number swell up to 120 million. And so powerful is a unit, by adding it to numbers, that it will infinitely enlarge them to such a vastness that shall transcend the capacity of the best arithmetician to count them. By such a meditation as this, you may have some prospect of the power of that God who is holy unity, the beginning of all things, as a unit is the beginning of all numbers, and can perform as many things really as a unit can numerically. That is, can do as much in the making of creatures as a unit can do in the multiplying of numbers. The omnipotence of God was scarce denied by any heathen that did not deny the being of God, and that was Pliny, and that upon weak arguments. 2. Indeed, we cannot have a conception of God if we conceive him not most powerful, as well as most wise. He is not a God that cannot do what he will and perform all his pleasure. If we imagine him restrained in his power, we imagine him limited in his essence. As he has an infinite knowledge to know what is possible, he cannot be without an infinite power to do what is possible, as he hath a will to resolve what he sees good. So he cannot want a power to perfect what he sees good to decree, as the essence of a creature cannot be conceived without that activity that belongs to his nature. And when you conceive fire, you cannot conceive it without a power of burning and warming. And when you conceive water, you cannot conceive it without a power of moistening and cleansing. So you cannot conceive an infinite essence without an infinite power of activity. And therefore a heathen could say, if you know God, you know he can do all things. And therefore, saith Austin, give me not only a Christian, but a Jew, and not only a Jew, but a heathen, that would deny God to be almighty. A Jew, a heathen, may deny Christ to be omnipotent. But no heathen will deny God to be omnipotent, and no devil will deny either to be so. God cannot be conceived without some power, for then he must be conceived without action. Whose, then, are those products and effects of power which are visible to us in the world? To whom do they belong? Who is the father of them? God cannot be conceived without a power suitable to his nature and essence. If we imagine him to be an infinite essence, we must imagine him to be an infinite power and strength. In particular, I shall show, 1, the nature of God's power, 2, reasons to prove that God must needs be powerful, 3, how his power appears in creation, in government, in redemption, and 4, the use. 1, what this power is, or the nature of it. 1. Power sometimes signifies authority, and a man is said to be mighty and powerful in regard of his dominion and the right he hath to command multitudes of other persons to take his part. But power taken for strength and power taken for authority are distinct things and may be separated from one another. Power may be without authority, as in successful invasions that have no just foundation. Authority may be without power, as in a just prince expelled by an unjust rebellion. The authority resides in him, though he be overpowered, and is destitute of strength to support and exercise that authority. The power of God is not to be understood of his authority and dominion, but his strength to act. And the word in the text properly signifies strength. 2. This power is divided ordinarily into absolute and ordinate. Absolute is that power whereby God is able to do that which he will not do, but is possible to be done. Ordinate is that power whereby God doth that which he hath decreed to do, that is, which he hath ordained or appointed to be exercised, which is not distinct powers, but one and the same power. His ordinate power is a part of his absolute. For if he had not a power to do everything that he could will, he might not have the power to do everything that he does will. The object of his absolute power is all things possible, such things that imply not a contradiction, such that are not repugnant in their own nature to be done, and such as are not contrary to the nature and perfections of God to be done. Those things that are repugnant in their own nature to be done are several, as to make a thing which is past not to be past. As, for example, the world is created. God could have chose whether he would create the world, or after it is created he had power to dissolve it. But after it was created, and when it is dissolved, it will be eternally true that the world was created, and that it was dissolved, for it is impossible that that which was once true should ever be false. If it be true that the world was created, it will be forever be true that it was created, and cannot be otherwise. And also, if it be once true that God hath decreed, it is impossible in his own nature to be true that God hath not decreed. Some things are repugnant to the nature and perfections of God, as it is impossible for his nature to die and perish, impossible for him, in regard of truth, to lie and deceive. But of this hereafter. Only at present to understand the object of God's absolute power to be things possible, that is, possible in nature, not by any strength in themselves or of themselves, for nothing hath no strength, and everything is nothing before it comes into being. So God, by his absolute power, might have prevented the sin of the fallen angels, and so have preserved them in their first habitation. He might, by his absolute power, have restrained the devil from tempting of Eve, or restrained her and Adam from swallowing the bait and joining hands with the temptation. But his absolute power, by his absolute power, God might have given the reins to Peter to portray his master, as well as to deny him, and employed Judas in the same glorious and successful service wherein he employed Paul. By his absolute power, he might have created the world millions of years before he did create it, and can reduce it into its empty nothing this moment. This the Baptist affirms when he tells us that God is able of these stones, meaning the stones in the wilderness, and not the people which came out to him out of Judea, which were children of Abraham, to raise up children to Abraham, in Matthew 3, verse 9. That is, there is a possibility of such a thing. There is no contradiction in it, but that God is able to do it if he please. But now the object of his ordinate power is all things ordained by him to be done, all things decreed by him. And because of the divine ordination of things, this power is called ordinate. And what is thus ordained by him, he cannot but do, because of his unchangeableness. By those powers are expressed in Matthew 26, verse 53-54, my Father can send 12 legions of angels. There is his absolute power. But how then shall the scriptures be fulfilled that thus it must be? There is his ordinate power. As his power is free from any act of his will, it is called absolute. As it is joined with an act of his will, It is called ordinate. His absolute power is necessary and belongs to his nature. His ordinate power is free and belongs to his will. A power guided by his will. Not, as I said before, that they are two distinct powers, both belonging to his nature, but the latter is the same with the former, only it is guided by his will and wisdom. 3. It follows then that the power of God is that ability and strength whereby he can bring to pass whatsoever he please, whatsoever his infinite wisdom can direct, and whatsoever the infinite purity of his will can resolve. Power, in the primary notion of it, does not signify an act, but an ability to bring a thing into act. It is power as able to act before it doth actually produce a thing. As God had an ability to create before he did create, he had power before he acted that power without. Power notes the principle of the action, and therefore is greater than the act itself. Power exercised and diffused in bringing forth and nursing in its particular objects without is inconceivably less than that strength which is infinite in himself, the same with his essence, as is indeed himself. By his power exercised, he doth whatsoever he actually wills. But by the power in his nature, he is able to do whatsoever he is able to will. The will of creatures may be, and is more extensive than their power, and their power more contracted and shortened than their will. But as the prophet says, his counsel shall stand, and he will do all his pleasure, in Isaiah 46, verse 10. His power is as great as his will, that is, whatever can fall within the verge of his will, falls within the compass of his power. Though he will never actually will this or that, yet supposing he should will it, he is able to perform it, so that you must, in your notion of divine power, enlarge it further than to think God can only do what he hath resolved to do, but that he hath as infinite capacity of power to act as he hath an infinite capacity of will to resolve. Besides, this power is of that nature that he can do whatsoever he pleases without difficulty, without resistance. It cannot be checked, restrained, or frustrated. As he can do all things possible in regard of the object, he can do all things easily in regard of the manner of acting. What in human artifices is knowledge, labor, industry, that in God is his will. His will works without labor. His works stand forth as he wills them. Hands and arms are ascribed to him for our conceptions, because our power of acting is distinct from our will. But God's power of acting is not really distinct from his will. It is sufficient to the exercise of a thing that God wills it to exist. He can act what he will only by his will, without any instruments. He needs no matter to work upon, because he can make something from nothing. All matter owes itself to his creative power. He needs no time to work in, for he can make time when he pleases to work, begin to work. He needs no copy to work by, because is his own pattern and copy in his works. All created agents want matter to work upon, instruments to work with, copies to work by, time to bring either the bursts of their minds or the works of their hands to perfection. for the power of God needs none of these things, but is of a vast and incomprehensible nature beyond all these, as nothing can be done without the compass of it. So itself is without compass of every created understanding. 4. This power is of a distinct conception from the wisdom and will of God. They are not really distinct, but according to our conceptions. We cannot discourse of divine things without observing some proportion of them with human, ascribing unto God the perfections sifted from the imperfections of our nature. In us there are three orders of understanding, will, power, and accordingly three acts, counsel, resolution, execution, which though they are distinct in us, are not really distinct in God. In our conceptions, the apprehension of a thing belongs to the understanding of God, determination to the will of God, direction to the wisdom of God, execution to the power of God. The knowledge of God regards a thing as possible, as it may be done. The wisdom of God regards a thing as fit and convenient be done. The will of God resolves that it shall be done. The power of God is the application of his will to effect what he hath resolved. Wisdom is a fixing the being of things, the measures and perfections of their several beings. Power is a conferring those perfections and beings upon them. His power is his ability to act, and his wisdom is the director of his action. His will orders, his wisdom guides, and his power effects. His will as the spring and his power as the worker are expressed in Psalm 115, verse 3. He hath done whatsoever he pleased. He commanded, and they were created, in Psalm 140, verse 5. And all three expressed in Ephesians 1, verse 11. Who works all things according to the counsel of his own will, so that the power of God is a perfection, as it were, subordinate to his understanding and will, to execute the results of his wisdom and the orders of his will, to his wisdom as directing, because he works skillfully, to his will as moving and applying, because he works voluntarily and freely. The exercise of his power depends upon his will. His will is the supreme cause of everything that stands up in time, and all things receive a being as he wills them. His power is but perpetually working and diffusing itself in the season his will hath fixed from eternity. It is his eternal will in perpetual and successive springs and streams in the creatures. It is nothing else but the constant efficiency of his omnipotent will. This must be understood as his ordinate power, but his absolute power is larger than his resolving will. For though the scriptures tell us he hath done whatsoever he will, yet it tells us not that he hath done whatsoever he could. He can do things that he will never do. Again, his power is distinguished from his will in regard to the exercise of it, which is after the act of his will. His will was conversant about objects when his power was not exercised about them. Creatures were the objects of his will from eternity, but they were not from eternity the effects of his power. His purpose to create was from eternity, but the execution of his purpose was in time. Now, this execution of his will we call his ordinate power. His wisdom and his will are supposed antecedent to his power as a counsel and resolve, as a cause precedes the performance of the purpose as the effect. Some distinguish his power from his understanding and will, in regard that his understanding and will are larger than his absolute power. For God understands sins, and wills to permit them. But he cannot himself do any evil or unjust action, nor have a power of doing it. But this is not to distinguish that divine power, but impotence. For to be unable to do evil is the perfection of power. And to be able to do things unjust and evil is a weakness, imperfection, and inability. Man indeed wills many things that he is not able to perform, and understands many things that he is not able to effect. He understands much of the creatures, something of sun, moon, and stars. He can conceive many suns, many moons, yet he is not able to create the least atom. But there is nothing that belongs to power but God understands, and able to effect. Sum this up. The will of God, the power of God, the will of God is the root of all. The wisdom of God is a copy of all, and the power of God is the framer of all. 5. The power of God gives activity to all the other perfections of his nature. It is of a larger extent and efficacy in regard of its objects than some perfections of his nature. I put them both together. 1. It contributes life and activity to all the other perfections of his nature. How vain would be his eternal counsels if power did not step in to execute them? His mercy would be a feeble pity if he were destitute of power to relieve, and his justice is a slighted scarecrow without power to punish. His promises an empty sound without power to accomplish them. As holiness is a beauty, so power is the life of all his attributes in their exercise. And as holiness, so power is an adjunct belonging to all, a term that may be given to all. God hath a powerful wisdom to attain his ends without interruption. He hath a powerful mercy to remove our misery. A powerful justice to lay all misery upon offenders. He hath a powerful truth to perform his promises. An infinite power to bestow rewards and inflict penalties. It is to this purpose power is first put in the two things which the psalmist had heard. In Psalm 62, verse 11 and 12, twice have I heard. Of two things have I heard. First, power, then mercy and justice, included in that expression. Thou renderest to every man according to his work. In every perfection of God, he heard of power. This is the arm, the hand of deity, which all other attributes lay hold on. When they would appear in their glory, this hands them to the world. By this they act, in this they triumph. Power framed every stage for their appearance in creation, providence, redemption. 2. It is of a larger extent in regard of its objects than some other attributes. Power does not always suppose an object, but constitutes an object. It supposeth an object in the act of preservation, but it makes an object in the act of creation. But mercy supposeth an object miserable, yet doth not make it so. Justice supposes an object criminal, but doth not constitute it so. Mercy supposes him miserable to relieve him. Justice supposes him criminal to punish him. But power supposes not a thing in real existence, but is possible. Or rather, it is from power that anything has a possibility, if there be no repugnancy in the nature of the thing. Again, power extends further than either mercy or justice. Mercy hath particular objects, which justice shall not at last be willing to punish. And justice hath particular objects, which mercy at last shall not be willing to refresh. But power doth, and always will, extend to the objects of both mercy and justice. A creature, as a creature, is neither the object of mercy nor justice, nor of rewarding goodness. A creature, as innocent, is the object of rewarding goodness. A creature, as miserable, is the object of compassionate mercy. A creature, as criminal, is the object of revenging justice. But all of them, the objects of power, in conjunction with these attributes of goodness, mercy, and justice to which they belong. All the objects that mercy and justice and truth and wisdom exercise themselves about have a possibility and a natural being from this perfection of divine power. It is power first frames a creature in the capacity of nature for mercy or justice, though it does not make an immediate qualification for the exercise of either. Power makes a man a rational creature, and so confers upon him a nature mutable, which may be miserable by its own fault, and punishable by God's justice, or pitiable by God's compassion, and relievable by God's mercy. But it doth not make him sinful, whereby he becomes miserable and perishable. Again, power runs through all the degrees of the state of a creature. As a thing is possible, or may be made, it is the object of absolute power. As it is factible, or ordered to be made, it is the object of ordinate power. As a thing is actually made and brought into being, it is the object of preserving power. So that power does stretch out its arms to all the works of God, in all their circumstances and at all times. When mercy ceases to relieve a creature, when justice ceases to punish a creature, power ceases not to preserve a creature. The blessed in heaven, they are out of reach of punishing justice, are forever maintained by power in that blessed condition. The damned in hell, that are cast out of the bosom of entreating mercy, are forever sustained in that remediless torment by the arm of power. 6. This power is originally and essentially in the nature of God and not distinct from his essence. It is originally and essentially in God. The strength and power of great kings is originally in their people and managed and ordered by the authority of the prince for the common good. Though a prince hath authority in his person to command, yet he hath not sufficient strength in his person, without the assistance of others, to make his commands to be made. He hath not a single strength in his own person to conquer countries and kingdoms and increase the number of his subjects. He must make use of the arms of his own subjects to overrun other places and yoke them under his dominion. But the power of all things that ever were, are, or shall be, is originally and essentially in God. It is not derived from anything without him. As the power of the greatest potentates in the world is. Therefore, in Psalm 62:11, it is said, power belongs unto God, that is, solely and to none else. He had the power to make his subjects, and as many as he pleases, to create worlds, to enjoin precepts, to execute penalties, without calling in the strength of his creatures to his aid. The strength that the subjects of a mortal prince have is not derived to them from the prince, though the exercise of it for this or that end is ordered and directed by the authority of the prince. But what strength soever anything hath to act as a means, it hath from the power of God as creator, as well as whatsoever authority it hath to act is from God, as a rector and governor of the world. God hath a strength to act without means, and no means can act anything without his power and strength communicated to them. As in the clouds in verse 8, before the text, are called God's clouds, his clouds. So all the strength of creatures may be called, and truly is, God's strength and power in them. A drop of power shot down from heaven, originally only in God. Creatures have but a little mite of power, somewhat communicated to them, somewhat kept and reserved from them, of what they are capable to possess. They have limited natures, and therefore a limited sphere of activity. Clothes can warm us, but not feed us. Bread can nourish us, but not clothe us. One plant has a medicinal quality against one disease, another against another. But God is a possessor of universal power, the common exchequer of this mighty treasure. He acts by creatures as not needing their power, but deriving power to them. What he acts by them, he could act himself without them. And what they act as from themselves is derived to them from him through invisible channels. And hence it will follow that because power is essentially in God, more operations of God are possible than are exerted. And as power is essentially in God, so it is not distinct from his essence. It belongs to God in regard of the inconceivable excellency and activity of his essence. And omnipotent is nothing but the divine essence, efficacious ad extra. It is his essence as operative and the immediate principle of operation, as the power of lightning in the sun and the power of heating in the fire are not distinct from the nature of them, but the nature of the sun bringing forth light and the nature of the fire bringing forth heat. The power of acting is the same with the substance of God through the action from that power be terminated in the creature. If the power of God were distinct from his essence, he were then compounded of substance and power and would not be the most simple being. As when the understanding is informed in several parts of knowledge, it is skilled in the government of cities and countries. It knows this or that art. It learns mathematics, philosophy, this or that science. The understanding hath the power to do this. But this power, whereby it learns those excellent things, and brings forth excellent verse, is not a thing distinct from the understanding itself. We may rather call it the understanding powerful than the power of the understanding. And so we may rather say God powerful than say the power of God, because his power is not distinct from his essence. From both these it will follow that this omnipotence is incommunicable to any creature. No creature can inherit it, because it is contradiction for any creature to have the essence of God. This omnipotence is a peculiar right of God, wherein no creature can share with him. To be omnipotent is to be essentially God. And for a creature to be omnipotent is for a creature to be its own creator. It being therefore the same with the essence of the Godhead, it cannot be communicated to the humanity of Christ, as the Lutherans say it is, without the communication of the essence of the Godhead. For then the humanity of Christ would not be humanity, but deity. If omnipotence were communicated to the humanity of Christ, the essence of God were also communicated to his humanity, and then eternity would be communicated. His humanity, then, was not given him in time. His humanity would be uncompounded, that is, his body would be no body, his soul no soul. Omnipotence is essentially in God. It is not distinct from the essence of God. It is his essence, omnipotent, able to do all things. This Reformation audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalogue containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, CDs and much more, at great discount, are on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, AB, Canada, T6L3T5. If you do not have a web connection, please request a free printed catalogue. If you do have a web connection and would like to be added to our email list, please send an email to ad@swrb.com or swrb@swrb.com with the word add in the subject line. SWRB's email list is a double opt-in list, so once you've sent us your email address, you'll be asked by mail to confirm that you want to join our list using the email address you have supplied. Your email information will be kept confidential, and you can easily remove yourself from our email list by simply emailing us at swrb@swrb.com with the word remove in the subject line. Once you are on our email list, you will be alerted to all the new free Reformation resources, free MP3s, free electronic books and texts, etc. SWRB makes available on the web, as well as at times, to our best discounts and super specials. We also encourage you to reproduce this audio resource and pass it on to your friends. But we only authorize this as long as the full contents of the message, including the header and trailer, is not altered in any way, and as long as the audio file or cassette is given away for free. Thank you again for listening to this SWRB reading. And remember that Isaiah 26, verse 3 states, "They will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. And 2 Corinthians 13:11 states, finally, brethren, farewell. Be perfect, be of good comfort, be of one mind, live in peace. And the God of love and peace shall be with you.